Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of Aquadocs, the podcast that keeps you up to date on all things aquatic medicine. I'm your host, Michelle Greenfield. This week, I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Eddie Haig, veterinarian at the Haig Veterinary Hospital in Washington. On this episode, we'll discuss Dr. Haig's pursuit of aquaculture medicine while working for his family's small animal practice. And we'll also chat about a case he recently worked on involving oyster herpes virus. So without further ado, hi, Eddie. Welcome to Aquadocs.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Super excited to have you here today. We're going to talk about some of the work you do with shellfish and bring oysters into the spotlight, which we haven't been able to do before. But before we get there, do you want to tell our listeners a little bit about what shaped your veterinary path to where you are today?
Sure. That'd be great. I was born and raised in Shelton, Washington. That's out on the West Coast near Olympia. Both of my parents were veterinarians. And so grew up in and around a veterinary hospital. Went to undergraduate at University of Washington, got a zoology degree, graduated in 2005. Graduated from vet school, Washington State University in 2010. And then went into practice, started working for a shellfish company in 2011 that needed help with international shipments, getting mainly oysters, but some clams into Canada. And then 3 years ago, was accepted into a fellowship program at University of Florida. That was an aquaculture fellowship program sponsored by USDA. Completed that and after coming out of that program, I actually ended up picking up a couple finfish producers that I'm helping them also with international shipments, getting eggs to all over the world.
Amazing. So since you mentioned the fellowship program at UF, can you talk a little bit more about that experience?
Yeah, it was a great experience. So there were eight of us throughout the country that were accepted into this program, and it was a fully sponsored program. We had 2 years of classes through the University of Florida and completed those virtually. Also being through COVID, it was all virtual. But before COVID happened, we were actually able to spend a full week in an intensive program at University of Florida's Tropical Aquaculture Lab. And we're able to sit through lectures for the week, but also see producers in the area and did some necropsies of animals there and talked about sampling and some of the things that they do through that lab and sort of some of the things that we would all be expected to do out in the field. The only real formal education that I had in aquaculture since I started.
I love what you highlighted at the end, that you had no previous training and then you were able to do this fellowship program and now you're able to see fish and do aquaculture medicine. So really highlighting opportunities for continuing education that actually can make such a difference in your career.
Yeah, I was really lucky when I first started doing shellfish work that the lab that we used up in Sequim, Washington, Dr. Ralph Elston, a PhD who runs that lab, was an amazing mentor for me. He really took me under his wing, showed me what I needed to know from the shellfish, how we were able to work with USDA to make sure these producers were able to keep working like they needed to. But that was all just on the job training and all me seeking advice and him helping me out versus something that was a more formal operation with the education. But without that, I can tell you that I wouldn't be as successful with aquaculture work as I am right now. And I consider what I do fun and enjoyable, but it also has turned into something that's profitable with my practice, which I think is really important too.
And we can talk a bit more about your practice. First off, it's a family business, which is absolutely adorable. But secondly, you are the epitome of what I would call a mixed practice.
Yeah. So like I mentioned at the beginning, both parents, Ohio State grads, and they've been in Washington since 79 and started to practice the Haig Veterinary Hospital about that time. They started out of a VW bus, as a lot of people did at that time, and were doing mainly out calls and farm calls. They eventually had a building and then they renovated a Grange Hall. And I would say that they were what would be considered a true mixed animal practice for an extended period of time. So they were daily doing out calls, daily seeing companion animals coming through the front door, daily seeing almost anything that called and needed to be seen. When I came in and started working, it had already shifted a bit to being more companion animal practice. But my first year doing aquaculture, it was about 2 to 3% of the gross revenue that came through the clinic. And it's grown since then. And hopefully continue to grow. And it's got up to about 12% of the gross revenue that we have coming through the clinic, which I think is great. But also, I see the need for more of this to happen. And when I talk to producers and when we go to conferences, I see producers really wanting more veterinary help. And not fighting it quite as much. But I also see that there's probably going to have to be some changes in how we operate as veterinarians in order to make that possible.
So let's talk about that then, because if we have listeners who are maybe doing small animal or mixed or interested in adding aquaculture to their practice, how does one go about and do that?
Yeah. And my situation might be a little bit different than a veterinarian treating a pet goldfish to some degree. I'm doing a lot of what you would sort of call regulatory type work for bigger producers that are trying to have international shipments. But there are a lot of people, no matter what type of aquaculture you want to get into, that they're looking for help. And sort of depending on what you want to do, being able to offer yourself up. The biggest struggle that I see is that aquaculture takes time away from some of those things that are sort of the bread and butter of veterinary medicine, which is most of us know are dogs and cats. And figuring out where you're going to spend your time is really tough. I would say that it works for me because I still have my parents who are veterinarians working at the practice. And it's going to be a bigger struggle if they're not there, because the minute I leave, some of the things that would be done are not going to be able to be done anymore. But I see that aquaculture going forward, if we're able to continue to grow and continue to do some things like utilizing some of our clinic staff to do things like we would utilize veterinary technicians in the hospital to help us out in aquaculture, could make it so that some of that time strains on a veterinarian aren't so severe. And we would be able to do more with the limited time that we have.
And when you're looking to involve the techs, what do you have in mind for them to be helping with?
Yeah, it's actually pretty new, but the last couple of weeks I've been in conversations with USDA about what type of things do I as a veterinarian need to be the one that solely does it. You know, in a small animal clinic, same thing. Our techs are not going in there and doing surgery, but our techs are helping us out with anesthesia. Our techs are helping us out with blood draws. Our techs are helping us out with sampling. Our techs are helping us out to make sure that things look right with animals on a daily basis. And my recent conversations with USDA is exactly that. What do I need to do versus what could I delegate or have somebody help me do? And we're working on that. And I think some of the things that I just mentioned with sample collections or getting things set up for testing is something that we really could utilize our office staff and find ways to do that. And we've already started to work with that and training some of my staff to help out with that. But those type of things are really, really time consuming. And I realized that if I can get some help getting that done, I'm going to be able to help out more people.
And you mentioned a few minutes ago that you've seen a shift in perspectives from the producers towards veterinarians and vice versa. So can you talk a little bit more about that and what your experience has been like?
Yeah, some of my experience has been because I've been doing it since 2011 now. So, you know, 11 years of work with it, I've developed a knowledge base that really helps people out versus year one, where every problem I was struggling to the same degree. But that's one thing over time, getting that experience. And that's the tough one, right? For a veterinarian that wants to be in aquaculture, that just takes time, takes experience. It's not something that gets handed to you. I also see that with the finfish producers, with the changes with the veterinary feed directive, where they need us to sign those type of VFDs in order to add medications to feed, there is a need to have us in the loop, have us part of their production to some degree. But I also think that those are the opportunities where veterinarians can show what we know as a whole and what we've been taught in veterinary school with herd health and some of these things that we don't even realize how intuitive it is to us, that you get on those facilities and you say, all right, I don't understand fish, but I understand if this was a group of cattle and we had this many in this area, there's going to be illness. Those animals are going to be stressed. They're not going to grow as well as they normally would. And I think some of those things are definitely ones that, again, it's intuitive to us. And you get to those areas and you learn about the biology of the fish, and then you can really say, well, everything else that I've learned helps me to get past this point and be able to help you more.
Yeah, I'm really glad you said that, because I actually last fall took a dairy health course where it was all the kids in my class that want to do dairy health and me. And I even went up to the professor and asked, and I said, hey, like, I have zero interest in cows. This is not at all what I'm going to do. but I am interested in potentially working with fish. And I see the connection. Can I and should I take this class? And he said exactly the same thing you did. Yeah, you know, the days that we're talking specific cow reproduction, that might not help you, but maybe that'll help you with the rhino. But on the flip side, all of the big management, biosecurity, herd health stuff we're doing, that's applicable across species. It was a great course, and I'm hoping that it'll really help me in the future.
And one of the things that brought up to one of the fellows, he's a dairy veterinarian. And I said to him, you know, the people in the cattle industry and some of these other industries have way more knowledge about feed, nutrition, and then also records than a lot of these producers have. And a lot of these producers are trying to do everything they can to try to do those type of things. But the cattle operations that some of the places have already figured all that out. And I think that, you know, even though the biology is different again with the feeds, some of that stuff really we can draw from and really help people out.
Yeah. And so apart from, you know, having discussions and classes in vet school about cows, where did you draw your help in your first few years when you were trying to incorporate aquaculture into your practice?
Yeah, Ralph Elston, the guy who was out of the lab up in SWIM, he was a great mentor for me. Any question I had, he was willing to go over it for as long as I possibly needed. The other thing that I did not bring up yet is that I got very, very good at dialing USDA APHIS's phone number. And I got very, very comfortable with talking to the USDA and got to the point that I developed working relationships with the people that were at the USDA so that when I had questions where you feel like it's a dumb question, I didn't have a problem doing it because I would start those conversations with, I want to make sure I do this right. And they want that done too. When things are done wrong or we have problems where we have to go figure them out afterwards, that's more time for everybody. And USDA, just like all of us, are their time's limited. They're struggling for enough time in their day also. But I think especially if you're going to be writing international health certificates, it's making sure that you have somebody that you can talk to and ask those type of questions.
Well, it's good advice for anyone who might want to incorporate this, is just asking questions, calling peers, calling USDA APHIS potentially.
Yeah, a lot of us get out and we figure that that might be scary. They're going to take our federal accreditation. And that's not true. You know, I've messed up a lot. And everything that I've done was because I was trying to do it right, but just didn't. That's the tough thing, is that if you're trying to do it right and it comes back and you have egg on your face, that's not something where anybody's going to do more than, hey, we got to figure out how to do this right next time.
Yeah, super important information. Thank you for telling us your journey and providing some insight into ways that we can get new advice if we want to incorporate aquaculture into our practice. And I'd love to transition now to talk about a case that you worked on involving oyster herpes virus. So why don't you start walking us through what happened with this case?
Sure. Thank you. This was probably 3.5-4 years ago now. And there was a concern that we had a positive oyster herpes virus case coming out of California. And this part's a little foggy, but it sounded like there was a shipment into San Francisco Bay Area that ended up having a positive oyster herpes virus hit. Now, oyster herpes virus, when you're talking about international shipment, the only one that's on our auxiliary testing sheet, and this gets a little bit detailed, is microvariant 1. Okay, so microvariant 1 is a variant that usually detrimental to juveniles. Not usually a big problem for adults, but could be. And the one that came into San Francisco Bay was what we're going to call microvariant X. But it looked like it was potentially more of a concern for all life stages. And so there was a lot of collaboration with USDA, the lab, fishing game, the people that have to manage those waterways, about, well, what should be done next step? And some of the stuff that we had decisions about were, how are we going to figure out if there is a problem here? What are we going to do to try to counteract that? What are we going to do to make sure that this doesn't biosecurity-wise cause problems other places? So we had a conference call with all these different groups involved. And I think that's really amazing because you get some really intelligent people on there, but also people that are just really experienced with these type of things. And some of the laboratory people that are on those type of talks, I think, are fascinating because they're able to tell you a wealth of knowledge of what would be the problems with this. And so what they decided to do is they decided to put some juvenile Pacific oysters into the area let them sit for a period of time and then resample them. And what ended up happening is that they put those animals in, they let them sit for about 6 months, I believe, and then they resampled them and couldn't find anything. I tested multiple times, couldn't find anything with PCR. And so what happened with that is that everything seemed like it was all right. The number one thing that I highlight with this, I had one question on that phone call. Who's doing the sample? You know, this is in California. I don't have a California license. I have no stake. Is the sampling going to be a veterinarian? Because as we know, if this is an avian influenza outbreak, if this is some other reportable disease, those are veterinarians that are doing that test. And it wasn't a veterinarian that was going to be doing this sample. And I always bring up when I talk about veterinarians getting jobs in aquaculture, I say, what does it look like if I have some of our international partners flying over the top of what we're doing? And they're looking down on that. And they say, all right, well, we have a problem, may or may not be a bigger problem. Who's going to be involved in that? And when I say, well, a veterinarian is not involved in that follow-up testing, I see that as something where veterinarians and aquaculture veterinarians have some places where we can still step up and help out and grow. And I think that's probably a lot of why you're doing this, right? Is that Aquadocs, which I think is amazing, is that, you know, we're trying to grow the knowledge about what type of jobs veterinarians could be a part of, trying to grow just the overall knowledge base with veterinary medicine being involved. And again, that case didn't end up having any other problems. And again, not quite as interesting as that goldfish that might need to be anesthetized to have a tumor removed off of it. But I also think that it does show that collaborating with a lot of individuals and having the veterinarian involved is really, really important. You know, the other thing that's a little interesting with this, my health certificate that I send internationally, it asks about microvariant type 1, and microvariant X isn't type 1. And so that means, well, if that was tested positive for, you have concerns that if a lab or somebody didn't report that appropriately, it might not get reported. And it might actually be a bigger problem. And when you talk about emerging diseases, which we all know about better than ever, you know, those type of things are something that a veterinarian working with those producers and with those people are going to be able to say, hold on, this could be a huge problem. Let's address it. Versus, you know, somebody else that it might just be another piece of paper coming through the desk.
So now that this case is over, have you tried to talk to folks about getting this variant X incorporated?
Yeah, you know, we've had conversations about that. There's a lot of diseases throughout the world. And if we put every single one on some of these concerns, that increases the cost for the producer big time. Because you're talking about PCR testing of 175 animals for something that may or may not be a problem in the United States. And so I think that if it was a problem, it would probably get on the concern list or on the auxiliary OIE list. But right now, it probably doesn't need to be there. But things could change, right?
That was a cool case. I'm really glad you shared it.
Thanks.
Cool. Well, we were also just chatting a little bit about your role and that you are traveling a lot to different farms and what that involves, you know, biosecurity wise, as well as how to manage your day. And so I was hoping you could share a little bit about that experience with our listeners.
Yeah, I'd love to. So I work for 4 main producers, and 2 of them are shellfish producers, 2 are finfish producers, and they're all in Washington State. I get to travel and do a lot of neat things in Washington State, which I appreciate not even having to leave the state to do this. But I'm going to give just an example about yesterday. So yesterday morning, I woke up, took the kids to school at 8 a.m., and I drove 2 hours out to Willapa Bay. Willapa Bay is a long, flat body of water that's really, really good for shellfish production. The main thing that's out there is oyster production, because every day, twice a day, there's large amounts of food for these oysters that come in and come out of that place, which is, thinking of it as a veterinarian, it's good and it's bad, because there's actually so much shellfish in that area that it's a concern for disease also. And if you think about that, you know, I have a lot of different producers, some of them I work for, some of them I don't, that work in that area. And you don't always know what everybody else is doing there, which is a problem with some of these open water type settings. But going back to what we were talking about, so I drove 2 hours, I hopped on a boat. The boat ride was probably about 30, 45 minutes, went out to a mud flat. The guy went before me, before I showed up, and he started to collect some of the oysters. I certified where the waterways were, where the oysters were, bagged them up, put them back on the boat, drove back 45 minutes to my car, and wrote an accession form for the lab. Then I boxed up those animals, and then I got to drive all the way from Willapa Bay back to where I live, which is Shelton, Washington, which is about a 2-hour drive. And then I got to drive all the way up to Quilcene, Washington. Quilcene, Washington is about another hour and a half north of where I was. So it was a lot of driving, but I can tell you this is that I appreciated it because I love being outside and seeing some of the things that I get to do, being out on the boat with some of these producers and just talking about what's going on with their shellfish productions. Pretty amazing. So once I got up to Quilcene, it's a hatchery setting. So these producers are growing up larvae seed to eventually be planted in open waterways, leased beaches, those type of things. So at the hatchery, I got to go up and they have large tanks that I was able to collect samples for of Pacific oysters for seed that was also going to the same lab. So throughout my day, I got to get up, go for a drive in a place that I wanted to be, get on a boat, go for a boat ride, get back in my car, drive back up to a hatchery, and then see an amazing operation. And these hatchery settings for shellfish are amazing. You know, a lot of light because they're having to grow a lot of algae to feed them. They have amazing setups. Some of it looks a little bit sci-fi. Collected those samples, put them in a bin, USDA sealed them so that I established a chain of possession for the lab. And then we sent them off to the lab. And that was all in one day. So that was an 8-hour day for me. I did it all, right? I didn't go back and do any dog or cat work that afternoon. I probably could have, but I decided to let Dad do the rest of the work for the day. And it was a great day. I came home and I had a smile on my face because I got to be around neat people. I got to help out with what's going on with these producers' day and trying to make it so that they're able to keep doing what they do.
Sounds like a great day. Always down for a boat ride. And apart from these rising gas prices, sounds overall like a great adventure.
Yeah, it doesn't always work out quite that well, but yes, it some days do. And, you know, I'll have some days where I'll be sampling trout in the morning and I'll have to do a visual exam on clam seed either early morning or afterwards, write a health certificate, and then the afternoon's dogs and cats, and sometimes even horses or cattle. You know, I don't think that's the norm anymore. I talk to a lot of veterinarians when I talk to them about mixed animal practice is that, you know, it's tough. Mixed animal practice, we treat them all like they're farm animals, right? We treat the cats like they're barn cats. We treat the dogs like they're farm dogs. But these are pets. People love them. They should be treated probably more like children to some degree. With the producers, with shellfish, it's amazing. So they talk about oyster larvae, which you have to look at under a microscope, and they call them their babies. And it's the same thing. When you invest that much time into something and you see these animals doing well, you care about them. Matter if they're licking your face first thing in the morning or whether they're sitting in a tank waiting for you to come feed them the next day. It's pretty amazing. And some of those people that work in the hatchery settings with shellfish care about those animals as much as a lot of dogs and cats get cared for out there.
And you get the best of all of that.
Yeah.
Well, before we close, I would love if you could share some advice or guidance with our student listeners, especially since, as you've just described, your job is very different than what others might expect when you say aquatic veterinarian.
Yeah, I think my advice, well, first off, when I've talked to people about aquaculture veterinary medicine, when I talk to veterinarians, most veterinarians that I talk to, when I start talking about sampling and looking at oysters and clams, their eyes light up. And it's amazing. Well, it's partly because they didn't think that even existed. These jobs that we're doing, didn't think that that was a veterinarian's job, didn't think that anybody would ever be doing that. But the main thing for veterinary students is seeing as much as they possibly can. And, you know, never pigeonhole yourself and saying that this is just what I'm going to do, because I didn't know 1 year out of vet school that I was going to be working, doing shellfish work and doing aquaculture work. I had no idea. I figured I was going to be seeing dogs and cats, horses, and occasional ag animals the rest of my life. And I was fine with that. But I think that the more that I was just said, yes, well, yeah, I'll help you out. Yep. Let's see what I can figure out. The more that it grew. And I think for vet students, it's the same thing. We have vet students that come through our practice, you know, that are first thing I tell them is, all right, well, what do you want to see? And if they say, I want to see something more than what I have to offer, I find them somebody that's going to be able to help them out with that. Because veterinary medicine can take you a lot of different directions. Some of it has nothing to do with veterinary medicine. Some of it has to do with podcasts. you know?
Thank you for that shout out.
Which is amazing. But, you know, I think that the knowledge base that we get and, you know, the experience and the people skills that we end up getting with veterinary medicine really can take us a lot of different directions and a lot of different ways. Hopefully we all find our own path and become happy with it. But that's the main thing that I try to get veterinary students to see.
Awesome. Well, we will definitely put contact info in the show notes. So if anyone listening is interested in spending some time working with, you know, the dogs, the cats, the horses, the cows, and the shellfish, go out to Washington and have some fun with Dr. Hagues.
Yeah. Perfect. Love it.
Well, Eddie, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you. I've learned so much today about, you know, how to have a true mixed practice and a little bit about oyster herpes virus. So thank you so much for being here on Aquadocs.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be a part of this. This is really amazing. Amazing that you're doing this. So keep it up. It's awesome.
And that's going to do it for this week's episode of Aquadocs. I'd like to thank Dr. Eddie Hague for being on the show this week, our sponsors WAVMA and AAFE, as well as all of you, our wonderful listeners, for tuning in. As always, check out our Facebook and Instagram to stay up to date on the latest Aquadocs news. And if you've got an extra moment, please rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts and leave a review. I'm Michelle Greenfield. Stay healthy, stay safe, and we'll see you next time here on Aquadocs.